Seems like just about everybody has a camera in hand or nearby, ready to record the events of the moment these days, even if it's just the cat falling off the refrigerator. We did not have cell phones or any other recording devices a long time ago, so we have to make educated guesses about events way back in time, including at the beginning of time itself. Now, that would be the viral video ever. In its absence, we have scientists like our next guest who spends a fair amount of time thinking about how the universe got started. Lawrence Krauss is a physicist at Arizona State University, visiting Ashland for a couple of speaking engagements, including one tonight at 7 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University, related to the coming publication of his new book, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Lawrence Krauss, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
It's nice to be back here.
So, boy, with your work at Arizona State University, you work on the early universe, the nature of dark matter, the origin of all mass in the universe. There are no questions too big, I guess, in your line of work.
The big questions are the interesting ones. I think we are all interested in big questions. Everyone wants to know where we came from or whether we're alone, all those questions.
So how much more do we know about the origins of the universe just in the last few years? It seems like every so often something comes along, a new particle discovered or new mass or new velocity in the universe even.
Yeah, there are discoveries being made. It's a golden age of both cosmology and, in some sense, particle physics. The discovery of most recently in particle physics of the Higgs particle, which is this invisible background field that's everywhere throughout space that's really responsible for our existence. It's, in some sense, the ultimate part of the greatest story ever told. That's just one example. But every time we look at the universe, yesterday I gave a lecture here called The Journey to the Beginning of Time, where I talked about the discovery of gravitational waves from colliding black holes 1.3 billion light years away. It's just amazing what's going on in the universe. And as I say, every day every day I'm surprised if I'm not surprised.
How do we measure things like gravitational waves? I mean, what sorts of gadgets and theories behind them have come along?
We create the most amazing gadgets that humans have ever created. The detecting gravitational waves, just to give you an example of the challenge. There are gravitational waves going right through this studio right now as we speak, and what they're doing is they're changing the size of this room. The size of this room is oscillating, getting smaller and larger. You may not notice it, depending on how late you were up last night. But we built a detector not too far away from here in Hanford, Washington, which has two arms at right angles that are 4 kilometers long. And it sounds simple. We just look for one arm to get shorter and the other one to get longer. But the amazing thing is that these two black holes that are 30 times the mass of the sun collided 1.3 billion light years away, producing these gravitational waves. Their effect would be to change one arm's length compared to the other, 4 kilometers long, but change the length by an amount equal to 1/1,000th the size of a proton. That's like measuring the distance between here and the nearest star to an accuracy of the width of a human hair. I mean, it's amazing that we can do that stuff. It's fascinating and wonderful.
As you were talking about the collision of the black holes, though, I was thinking if they were 1.3 billion light years away, so if we know about it now,
That happened 1.3 billion
years ago.
And what's really, it's poignant because, in fact, that meant the signal took 1.3 billion years to get to us. And it turned out this detector, which has really taken 40 years to build, was ready, and they did an engineering run and turned it on, and the head of the experiment said, well, we won't take data, but of course they didn't listen to him. Within an hour of turning it on, they saw that event. And if they'd waited an hour, that event that happened 1.3 billion years ago would have been missed. It's an amazing bit of fortuitous wonder. That's part of the excitement of science.
Has it detected anything since?
In fact, yeah, it has detected. There's already a publication of another event. I've heard there's a few more. We expected maybe an event a month, but we didn't know because we don't even know if those black holes existed. It was a pure theory before that. And so it's finding what we expected, but what'll be more exciting, I'm sure, is it'll find what we didn't expect. And that will be every time we open a new window in the universe, as I say, we are surprised. So this is the astronomy of the 21st and 22nd century. Now, the Large Hadron Collider, which discovered the Higgs, is the most complicated machine that was ever built by humans. It's like the Gothic cathedrals of the 21st century. It involves a tunnel that's 26 kilometers long with a vacuum that's sparser than the vacuum of space, with many tons of superconducting of liquid helium and thousands of superconducting magnets, and we accelerate particles at 99.9999% the speed of light in one direction and 99.99999% the speed of light in the other direction and collide them each millions of times each second. Each second, more data is generated at the Large Hadron Collider than in all the libraries on Earth. And it's just amazing to think of the detectors are immense. Each detector, the smaller of the two detectors, has more iron than the Eiffel Tower, and all of this is done to understand ultimately why we're here. It's amazing.
We talked to a University of Oregon professor not long ago who does work that is done through the Large Hadron Collider. She was telling us, though, about the complexity of the machinery and about the fact that I guess they had a breakdown one day because of some rodent had gotten in there and chewed the wires or
well,
something.
Well, there was a short. You know, more current is going through that every when it's on than powers the entire city of Geneva that it's right next to. And it's only possible because these magnets and these current wires are superconducting. But if ever anyone goes normal, the amount of energy generated is like a jet plane crashing into the device. And so what that's happened, and it destroyed a lot of magnets early on. They had to be rebuilt. But it's been functioning beautifully. And it's an amazing facility. And it's as I say, I said it was like the Gothic Cathedral of the 21st century for a reason. The Gothic cathedrals were sort of pushed to the limits of technology back when they were built. They involved artisans from dozens of countries working for centuries. Well, the Large Hadron Collider took 25 years to build by 10,000 physicists from 100 countries, speaking dozens of languages, many different religions. They all work together. It's the beauty of science. They all work together to a common goal. And in this case, it's the beauty of nature. It's amazing.
Lawrence Krauss is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, cosmologist and physicist and so much more. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Since you mentioned Gothic cathedrals, I wonder if we might step into the realm of religion and science.
If
and,
we have to, sure.
Because I notice this always seems to come up on blogs by you, about you, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, can they coexist?
Well, they can coexist, but they can't be. But they're not consistent. People happily carry mutually inconsistent ideas around with them all the time. We all have to, in a way. We all invent 10 impossible things before breakfast just to get to work in the morning. But the doctrines of the world's organized religions are not consistent with science. Just the way it is. Now, the vague notion that there's some purpose and meaning to the universe, that vague notion isn't inconsistent with science. Although there's no evidence. But that vague notion isn't the same notion that said, you blew a horn and the earth stopped or people get resurrected from the dead. Those things just don't happen.
I think about the ways in which religion interfered with science, prevented the growth of science over the years. You know, you could get excommunicated for insisting upon the immutable laws of the universe.
Yeah, I mean, Galileo is a famous example. He was tried for heresy for saying that the earth went around the sun. Ultimately, the Catholic Church came around. It took them a long time. So the problem is that when doctrines – the real problem is when you assume – you know the answers before you even ask the questions. That's the real problem. And to assume you know the truth before you've investigated to see what the truth is the real problem. And it is when – and it doesn't always happen. Of course, there's lots of religious people who are, who accept the results of science and moreover are interested in some sense potentially changing their ideas. But those people who've decided that this ancient book written by Iron Age peasants before we knew the earth orbited the sun contains all the wisdom of nature, and therefore if we discover anything and it disagrees with that book, it must be wrong. Those people have a problem. And even Saint, Moses Maimonides, who was a famous religious scholar, said, he said the Bible is absolutely true. But if your interpretation of the Bible disagrees with the results of science, you better reexamine your interpretation of the Bible. And it was a sensible thing to say, and there are sensible theologians. But most people, I think, my problem, and I hadn't planned to go in this direction, but is that religion has usurped morality so that many people, after our movies and books and other things, come to me and say, I discovered I'm not alone, and I'm not a bad person for asking the question, does God exist? A lot of people ask that question, but there are a lot of places around the country where if you ask the question, you feel evil. And you can be a perfectly good person. And in fact, the Bible is not only not a guide for how the physical universe works, but if you actually read the Old Testament. It's certainly no guide for morality. You wouldn't want to. Most people who declare themselves religious, what we all do is we all want to believe. And they pick and choose the things they like. They ignore the part where it says stone your children if they disobey you. But in fact, in England, a survey was done, but in this case by the Richard Dawkins Foundation, of people who declared their religion. In this case, only about 53% now of it, people in England declare their Church of England. And they said, why did you declare yourself Christian? Did you believe in transubstantiation? No. Do you believe in the virgin birth? No. And all the lists went down, and they said, well, why did you declare yourself this way? And the answer was, we want to think of ourselves as good people. And I think a lot of people go to church or call themselves whatever Christian, whatever religion their parents were, probably, mostly to make themselves feel better and to hope that faith will make them better people. And it's fine. If it does, great. But you don't need it to be a good person.
Lawrence Krauss, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Had intended to go quite that far down the
religion
and science
trip. Yeah, I know, but you started it. You opened Pandora's box.
I know. He's a physicist at Arizona State University and in Ashland for a couple of speaking engagements, including one tonight at 7 at the Science Building at SOU with Overflow in the Meese Auditorium at the Center for Visual Arts. You can join us right now on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call. Here's Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. Yeah, you've got to be careful of that science stuff. I mean, if you believed science, then you would have had to have disbelieved all the deep ocean life forms that exist in impossible conditions.
No,
however,
I'm sorry,
I wanted to call about.
I think we discovered them because of science. But anyway, go on.
Yes, yeah. I wanted to call. You know, of course, about the electron behavior at a distance phenomenon.
Uh huh.
Your story about turning on the gravity wave gadget.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't just do that. You knew to turn on the gadget. That is where knowledge and science has to go. Until we research this universal consciousness that some people might use as a definition for God, you're standing inside the elephant trying to look out, and you can't even see the box the elephant is in.
So there was a non-scientific motivation, you're saying, to commit the science?
No.
I'm saying there's a universal consciousness that somehow directed us to that. Well, you know, there's no evidence.
The direction physics has to go.
It doesn't. No. The great thing about science is we don't know the direction it has to go till we do it. And usually we're surprised. In fact, usually we turn on a machine for one reason and discover something else that forces us to change our mind. And that's the wonderful aspect of science. And in fact, the thing we should be doing when we're teaching kids is not filling their mind with facts, because you have a phone and Google for that. But the process of science, questioning, really we should be encouraging kids to ask questions. And the great thing that both parents and teachers should be excited about saying is, I don't know. I'm not knowing is very exciting. I don't know. Let's figure out how to find out the answer. Let's see where the answer is. And let's be willing to change our minds. That's probably the most important thing that science teaches us, is that being wrong is no problem, because it means we're learning something.
Well, yeah. So you can have errors, or at least, okay, we had a hypothesis and it didn't work out. So now where do we go?
It's usually more exciting. As I often say, as a theoretical physicist, the two most exciting states to be in are confused and wrong.
As opposed to liquid and gaseous. Let's take another call. Don in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lawrence Krauss.
Good morning, Dr. Krauss. I want to say two things. That my faith is based on experience, and it's, as a former scientist, I guess you could say, I had a religious person who told me, have faith in your doubts. And I think that was good advice.
Mm-hmm.
I do it. It's unavoidable. I mean, the comment, you don't be afraid to see what you see.
Mm-hmm.
But I was at I was working at Hughes Aircraft in the 50s as sort of a graduate student, mm-hmm. and another graduate student there did something remarkable. He was an optics student, I guess you could say, and his name was Ted Maiman.
Mm-hmm.
Down the hall, he said, hey guys, come and look and see, it's working. And we went down, he'd taken a ruby and polished it in a certain way and shot microwave energy into it.
Mm-hmm.
And out came coherent light for the first time in history, and
ruby laser.
It actually proved the theory from the Bell Labs. The lasing thing, and to be there and to experience that years later after living in Italy. Of course, my right brain took over and sent me in another direction. But I don't know. You call it creative, but science can be equally sexy and creative.
Well, science is based on creativity. Yes,
mm-hmm. It is, and we have some Shia Muslim relatives who mm-hmm. used to email me messages from the Quran, and one of the quotations I like is that a good question is the beginning of education, and I think that it goes along with what you say, and I think if we could just converge like those people did at CERN, you know, and mm-hmm. and work together to discover what's real, I think the whole surprise is there waiting for us.
All right, Don, thanks for that.
I appreciate what you said. It's a matter of coming together and not letting our prejudices get in the way, and using and keeping open questioning. And it's you just gave an example. It's wonderful if people can take from whatever faith they may have a positive message, and that happens. It's not as if it doesn't happen. The all I'm saying is that the actual doctrines of, you know, for example, in the Quran or elsewhere, which says the moon was split in two, and those things are incorrect. That's fine. But maybe the things that people wanted to hope for humanity are, in some cases, are good guides, in some cases are bad guides. The point is that you choose which and you should use reason to choose which doctrines or which proposals or which suggestions are ones you should utilize in your life, and we should use reason and rationality and goodwill to do those things, and we don't need and those things we all have regardless of our religious beliefs.
Lawrence Krauss, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Here's George and Eugene. Welcome.
Hi, guys. I'm curious, Doctor, what your view is of the electric universe, addendum to gravitational cosmology, and therefore physics.
It doesn't really make sense. the idea is that somehow our observations of the universe, which is expanding, and tell us that the universe is 13.8 billion years old, and there was a Big Bang. That somehow that those observations are wrong, and it's other phenomena related to electromagnetism that explain those. The point is that there's not one, but more than 50. There's many, many different tests you can do about this idea, and they all are consistent with the same picture. Everything works. The age of our galaxy, we can work out the age of the oldest stars, the distance to distant stars, and the phenomena that happen. All of it only hangs together with that one picture, and you could try and come up with some idea that explains one observation, but it won't explain the rest. And the electric universe is an idea by people basically who didn't like the expanding universe and the notion that gravity is the governing force that determines the evolution of structure. But as I say, the description that occurred was not a postdiction; it was a prediction. The Big Bang picture makes many predictions which were tested. It wasn't just to explain phenomena we already saw. That's really important, because for science to be reasonable, it has to be falsifiable. You have to be able to propose something you can test, and it could be wrong. And these ideas were gave us predictions of many, 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 many things over the last 60 years that have been tested. And so the picture holds together remarkably well. That doesn't mean there aren't mysteries and puzzles. There certainly are. There are big puzzles, and I talked about some of them last night. I'll talk about some more tonight. And those puzzles are what keep us going.
I love the story that I didn't know about until just a couple of years ago about the scientists who figured out that why the Earth is not the center of the universe, because in order for that to be the case, objects in the sky needed to move in one direction sometimes and a different direction other times. They had to make loop the loops, essentially.
They were called epicycles in order to explain, because in fact, if you look, it's very simple to understand now in principle. If you look at planets, sometimes they move forward and sometimes they move backwards in the sky. Why is that? It's because we're on an orbit that's closer to the sun than those planets. So sometimes we're catching up with them, and sometimes they're catching up with us, depending upon where they are on the sky. So in order to explain that motion, you'd have to assume really weird motion. Or guess what? We all orbit the sun, and then all of it comes out much more simply.
John in Ashland wrote a question. He wants to know how Drake's Law has changed over the past decade of discoveries.
Does he mean the Drake equation? I assume he means the Drake equation for the which is not really an equation, but it's an estimate of the probability of that life exists, intelligent life exists elsewhere in the universe. Those probabilities have evolved because one of the things that's dramatically changed in the last 20 years, although most of us, most astrophysicists kind of guess that there were many other planetary systems, we've actually now measured them with the Kepler satellite and other things. We've discovered almost every star we see has planets around it. In fact, planets that are even more exotic than we ever imagined could be possible. And therefore, we know there are 100 billion stars in our own galaxy. There are probably 100 billion solar systems. So we've learned that the potential for habitable planets like Earth is much greater than we thought before. Moreover, we've seen organic materials around comets and in comets in space, the basis of amino acids. So all the evidence suggests that the probability of life in the universe is great. It's greater than it was before. Now, does that mean that intelligent life exists in the universe? We don't know. We have to look and find out.
To be continued, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Lawrence Krauss is a physicist and the director of an institute at Arizona State University. He's at Southern Oregon University to talk about the campus theme, Shapes of Curiosity. His lecture tonight is called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, also the title of his next book coming out sometime next year.
Yeah, it's coming out in March. The Greatest Story Ever Told comes out in early March, but you can order it now on Amazon.
Good to know. The presentation is tonight at 7 at the Science Building at Southern Oregon University. If there's no room there, there's overflow at the Meese Auditorium at the Center for Visual Arts. Lawrence Krauss, good to have you back after 6 years.
It's always good to be back here. Thanks.